I'm Gary Naughan. I'd like to welcome you to this program. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Each week at this time, we select a very important topic, one that is not generally covered in the mainstream media, and bring on individuals who offer an independent and important progressive point of view. Over the weekend, I watched all the different news shows to see was anyone tackling our trade agreements, especially the TPP. None were. I then went up to see how many articles had been written in the mainstream or alternative media in the past month. I could only find two, and those were just in the alternative media. But think about something that's this important, something that could impact over 600 million people, that's worth over $20 trillion annually in trade. And then we have to say, well, hold on, does this have anything to do with NAFTA or GATT or the World Trade Organization? And the answer is yes. And we're going to show you exactly what this is. Our special, we're going to look at the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement, Obama's record on trade and agreements, and what it means for all of us. My guest today, Arthur Stamoulis, he is the new Director for the Citizens Trade Campaign, which is a national coalition of environmental, labor, and consumer and family farm, religious and other civic organizations, dedicated to improving the North American Free Trade Agreement and to advance economic justice and human rights. Prior to taking the helm at the Citizens Campaign, Arthur spent years with the Oregon Fair Trade Campaign and is a veteran of the Seattle demonstrations against the World Trade Organization. He also was present for the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement negotiations that took place this past weekend in San Diego. Website is citizenstrade.org. Arthur, we're going to come to you in a few moments, all right? Are you there?
I am. Thanks for having me.
We look forward to speaking with you in just a few moments. But introducing our second panelist today is Lori Wallach. Lori is director of Public Citizens Global Trade Watch Division, and has promoted the public interest regarding World Trade Organization's agenda and globalization and international commercial agreements to Congress and foreign parliaments, the courts, the governmental agencies, and the media. Wall Street Journal described her as Ralph Nader with a sense of humor. The National Journal calls her the trade debates guerrilla warrior. And she is tough as an opponent against many of these major organizations, but very much on the side of the American and world citizens. She's working closely with civil society scholars and activists in developing countries and with U.S. congressional environmental labor groups. She has spearheaded the debate on free trade agreements and globalization on jobs, livelihood, and wages, and in the environment and public health and safety, equality, and social justice. She has testified to over 20 congressional committees on trade and globalization. She is the author of Whose Trade Organization? A Comprehensive Guide to the World Trade Organization, and has contributed to numerous anthologies. And she just recently participated in the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement negotiations that took place in San Diego. She's a graduate of Wesley College and Harvard Law School. The website is tradewatch.org. Nice to have you with us today, Lori.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Lori, I'm going to begin with you because I understand that you have to leave early, and then we'll go to with our guest Arthur. And I'd like to break this into a couple of segments before we get to the Trans-Pacific Partnership in specific. My concern is that the average American over the past 20 years really doesn't understand what all these trade agreements mean and how they really benefit individuals, especially people who, let's say, a union worker in Akron, Ohio, maybe works in a tire-making factory. They hear about these trade agreements, and then the question is, have these agreements from NAFTA and GATT and now this new one and CAFTA, do these really represent what is in the best interest of the American worker, the ability to keep jobs in the United States, and to help our overall economy? Or is there another agenda that we have not been told about? And could you explain these in some detail for us so at least we understand what these agreements are about?
Well, first of all, they're not mainly about trade. The agreements since NAFTA and WTO, since the middle 1990s, aren't anything like the old-fashioned trade agreements that cut border taxes, called tariffs, on goods. Rather, this new model of agreement is much better understood as a delivery mechanism for a broad corporate agenda. And I don't say that with some conspiratorial glint. In fact, there are over 600 official corporate U.S. trade advisors. In that mix are 10 unions, one environmental group, and one health group. So under the old theory of he or she who pays the piper calls the tune, these trade agreements have become very much instruments by and for the big global corporations to implement a whole agenda, much of which would have a hard time getting through even the most conservative Congresses. What do I mean by this? For instance, the Trans-Pacific Partnership has proposed 26 chapters. Two of them actually deal with traditional trade. The other 24 chapters include things like new monopolies for pharmaceutical companies' patents to increase drug prices, a ban on the use of local or Buy America preferences when our state and local and federal government is buying goods and services with our own tax dollars, so our own tax dollars can't be sewn back into our local economies. New foreign investor rights that not only give special privileges to foreign companies, better treatment is required by our own government than they give domestic companies and individuals, but these corporations have all kinds of new abilities to attack our domestic laws as undermining their expected future profits, not in our courts, but in international tribunals where three trade lawyers, no conflict of interest, rotate between acting as judges and suing governments for the corporations. And when the corporations win, they can demand payment of our tax dollars for their regulatory costs, the very environmental zoning health laws that U.S. companies meet that we all rely on. The rules include limits on both inspection and safety standard for food, imported food, for products. The rules include new rights for deregulation for big banks. For instance, you're simply forbidden from banning a risky derivative or other product. The rules guarantee rights for big corporations to speculate, to move money with no limits, including the many what are called capital controls that countries have started to use to avoid risky speculative sloshes in and out of money. These are just a handful of the non-trade corporate rules that these agreements implement. And I will just close, as people are saying, how can that be? I will just finish the thought by saying the first chapter of each of these agreements has a provision that requires each country shall ensure the conformity of its domestic laws, regulations, and administrative procedures with the attached agreements. Every country is required to conform its existing and future laws to all of these new constraints on government regulation for our health and safety, and all of these new grants of powers to corporations. And if a country, a state, a locality fails to do this, if our elected governments do not conform to this imposition of corporate governance, then we have trade sanctions imposed against our country, sanctions, until we change the law to meet the rules. This is actually enforceable, top-down, one-size-fits-all corporate governance. It's not really about trade.
Wow. So would that by implication mean that if someone wanted to start a campaign to hire more Americans, to rebuild American economies and infrastructure, but some of these multinational corporations found a way that it was more profitable to be doing products and services out of the United States, that if they ran up against any regulations that we have or barriers that we have, they could sue and end up winning, and the American taxpayer would pay for what their perceived or projected lost profits would be?
Correct. And if this sounds too far-fetched, There's a slightly less grandiose version of this in NAFTA relative to what's being proposed for the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the TPP. And under NAFTA, $350 million plus has already been paid out to corporations and investors who've gone to these World Bank tribunals, I call them kangaroo courts of trade lawyers, and they have successfully extracted taxpayer funds over attacks on forestry laws, toxics bans, permits for operating dangerous services, zoning rules, basic health and safety laws, $350 million in our taxpayer funds for the three NAFTA countries paid to corporations for their right not to follow the rules. Moreover, these investor privileges also facilitate offshoring. So you asked about the tire worker in Akron. Many Americans know that since NAFTA and the World Trade Organization, the U.S. trade deficit has exploded. So instead of making things here and shipping them, exporting them to other countries, we have exported our investment and our jobs, and we now import the goods we used to make here. Same brand name, but made someplace with lower labor costs, cheap labor, where people can't organize a union, where toxins can be dumped on the ground. Over 5 million U.S. manufacturing, just manufacturing, jobs have been lost since NAFTA and the World Trade Organization, slightly less than 20 years. 40,000-plus manufacturing facilities gone. This was one out of every four U.S. manufacturing job. This is a wrenching, horrific shift. It's relating to why, as many people have realized, our good, higher-paid jobs are leaving. We now have median real income at 1970s level, which is to say we have outsourced these good union-organized, benefits-paying, good wage-paying jobs. And I'm not talking about just, for instance, as is the myth, the quote-unquote lower end of manufacturing. We're talking about aerospace, computers, the high end, the future, solar, the new energy economy. We're shipping out all of those jobs and the related technology. And now there are proposals in the TPP to facilitate the offshoring now of the service sector and professional services jobs. How does this work? The agreements provide special privileges and safeguards. So, for instance, there's a guaranteed minimum standard of treatment a company must be given if it leaves and relocates to another country. There is compensation for regulatory costs, as I mentioned. You never have to trust the other country's courts. You can go to these corporate tribunals. All of these incentives make it much less risky and much more profitable to relocate. And as a result, these agreements that have these investment rules promote the export of jobs and investment, not goods. This is a choice. I could write, as a recovering trade attorney, I could write a real trade agreement that would be a lift-up agreement that would require an improvement, for instance, in safety standards, that would put responsibilities on investors operating in any country in an agreement. But that's not what we have. What we have is race-to-the-bottom agreements that limit our democratically elected governments from putting in policies we need and that give new rights and privileges to basically the worst of the footloose multinational companies. This is a policy choice. This is not an inevitability. So as horrible as this sounds, the only upside is if we organize the power to change it. It is not inevitable. It's just one version. We can do better.
All right. Over the weekend, as I mentioned at the top of the program, I looked at every single talking show on television that brings forth to their viewers important issues. This was not on any of those channels. I then Googled and looked at all the major media in the United States and around the world to see how many people were actually covering the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement and how many were looking at it as you would look at it. From is this an advantage or disadvantage to the United States? And outside of a few rather obscure places on the Internet, no one is touching this. And I'm thinking, how could something that could impact over 600 million people's lives and represent about $20 trillion in total trade, how could this not be something that's vigorously debated with some transparency, yet it wasn't? Now, two thoughts for you, please, if you would. I remember about 14 years ago, looking at an issue that I found almost impossible to accept, and that was that a company outside the United States, I think it was in Canada, was selling a product. I believe it was some form of farming product or pesticide in California, but it had been shown to be toxic and therefore polluting the water. And California's environmental standards said, we don't want this product. They sued through the World Trade Organization and won, and California had to pay them years worth of lost potential profits. And I thought, well, that's absurd. If something was shown to cause cancer, adulterate the environment, and be toxic to human health, why would we acquiesce? And the rule was simple. Whatever was in that agreement, in the NAFTA agreement in that case, won the day. And I thought, well, that should be repealed. So when the presidential debates came, and in, I believe it was in Columbus or Cleveland, when all the Democratic candidates were saying what they would do on NAFTA, it was only Dennis Kucinich who said he would repeal NAFTA and start from scratch. And Obama said, well, he would look into it. And then the next day, a memo was received that he had sent the people involved in NAFTA, his trade partners, in this case Canada, a note saying, this is just campaign rhetoric of some form. Don't worry about it. Nothing's going to change. And I thought, surely someone would talk about this. No one did. So when you look at this treaty, is there this potential? Is there the potential for China or India to manufacture some products that are toxic, shown to be toxic, but could be sold in this country or wouldn't be allowed to be stopped from being sold because of this agreement? Or do we have those kind of protections to keep toxic elements, toxic chemicals, toxic food, toxic drugs, toxic medications out of the marketplace?
Under the agreements, we're supposed to accept goods that do not actually meet our standards, which is, in fact, horrifying. And moreover, when companies, foreign companies, are operating here, we have limits on how we can regulate them. Even if the U.S. company next door, we can regulate. So it is both dangerous for the environment and health and fundamentally unfair. Now, this is already in NAFTA and CAFTA, but the big fight is over this Trans-Pacific Partnership, because this agreement is, as the Obama administration points out, going to be the last agreement they negotiate. Instead of ever negotiating new rules where things could get better, the goal is to just have every country sign up to these rules. So the big corporations are extremely focused on making sure that the TPP is like NAFTA on steroids. Everything problematic in NAFTA, plus, plus, plus. The only good news is people in some other countries and some of the other governments have been saying no to these outlandish, outrageous U.S. proposals about jacking up pharmaceutical prices with new monopolies, about banning financial regulation to make the world safe for speculators, about having these crazy limits on internet freedom that are being proposed in the guise of copyright proposals. It's like a backdoor SOPA, the over-the-top anti-internet freedom law that was killed in Congress. The other countries are fighting back, and on your point about the transparency, this is the one thing every listener can do. There's lots of information on our website, tradewatch.org. Some of it's as small as a postcard you can print out and send to somebody. Some of it is more detailed. You can email it, you can print it, you can hand it out. We have to pass the word. In the past, some of these crazy corporate coup d'etat via trade agreement strategies have been stopped. There was one called the Free Trade Area of the Americas. It was supposed to be NAFTA from the Arctic to the Antarctic, to 34 countries, same kind of craziness as TPP. That agreement, once exposed to the sunshine, like Dracula, did not fare well. For over a year, people got the word out person to person. And this was before the internet was as widely used as now. Folks can put it on their Facebook pages. We have some very funny videos you can link to on your Facebook pages. We have a parody video of the ABC Jackson 5 song that's TPP. The Yes Men did a hilarious prank on the last round of negotiations. There's a very funny YouTube video. You can find that on our website as well. Fact sheets. We have to get the word out, because if we can expose the TPP, and you're exactly right, the mainstream media is not covering it at all. It's scandalous. If we can expose it and force it into the sunshine, it cannot go forward. It's so overly over the top and grandiose. And in fact, part of this sadly, heartbreakingly U.S. government strategy is to keep it totally secret until it's done. So right now, even relative to some of the past secrecy around trade agreements, the TPP is by far the deepest hidden in the crypt. Even the U.S. Senator, Senator Ron Wyden, a guy who tends to support these agreements, who is the chairman of the Senate Committee on Trade, the man with official legal jurisdiction, is being denied access to review the draft text of this agreement. A month ago, a leak occurred, the investor rights chapter leaked. Again, in our website, tradewatch.org, you can see that text. You can see our analysis, which walks you through it, translated out of trade jargon, and gives you some ideas of things you can do to spread the word, to wake up members of Congress. That was the final straw, and 135 members of Congress, Democrats all, wrote to the Obama administration and said, you must release the entire text. It is those kind of demands to get that text out there, that's what we have to do, because the secrecy is the only way they're going to get away with actually finishing this. So for all of us, our strongest duty as a citizen is to keep our mouths open, which is to say, to talk to everyone, to pass the word, to make sure that we have this dragged into the sunshine where it will not survive.
So if I understand what you are suggesting, this is going to, in effect, give power to corporations, multinational corporations and major corporations in the United States and elsewhere, the ability to, in effect, undermine our environmental rules, our health safeguards. It could bring toxic drugs and food into the United States. It would lessen the access to needed medicine, and we wouldn't be able to have then an ability to hold them accountable, because no court in the United States would have jurisdiction. If we found some egregious act, we would have to go through these, as you said, kangaroo courts, where it's their own people who are jumping, juxtapositioning from a lawyer suing on behalf of a multinational to the same lawyer being the referee and adjudicating, which is a gross conflict of interest. And also there's a high probability, and this is my final point, but I want to put a dot on this one because I believe that this needs to be said. When I look carefully at all this, what I see is that many employers right now, not only in the United States, but in other countries, are looking at their bottom lines and saying, okay, we've got robotics, and we have state-of-the-art computers, and we have automation. We have every form of technology. So what do we not need? We don't need employees, especially those who are well-compensated, who spent years with graduate degrees to get a high level of competence. A, through special visas, we can bring them into the United States and pay half the amount and get rid of the ones we have here. So then they're looking towards a one-world economy. And if that's what they're looking for, then they're looking to make everyone else receive slave labor wages. So then the idea is, how then are American workers supposed to compete? And my answer is, we cannot compete. There is no way in the world that if you're a manufacturing company, you're a small business person, you're trying to do something, and you're competing at, let's say, $20 an hour, and someone in India is willing to work for two, or someone in China for three, you can't compete. So we're not only not going to create jobs, we're going to put the final kibosh on this whole movement to pull ourselves up, and we're going to destroy effective competition. And then the only competition the average American is going to have, if you're skilled or college graduate, you're not just coming out and looking at other graduates from your school and other schools. You're looking at hundreds of millions of other people around the world who want to work, deserve to work, and now they're willing to work 12 and 14-hour shifts in terrible conditions for a dollar an hour. Are you willing to do that? And, Lori, I believe that unless we pull back and look at the long-term consequences, we could be looking at America becoming almost an indentured nation in the labor force. Those are my thoughts. I'd like your final thoughts on this, please.
Well, my final thoughts are, we don't have to have a future of this horrible race to the bottom. because, again, these are not acts of God. These are not rules that came from Mount Sinai. This is not scientific inevitability. This is just one version of rules that one set of interests, very large multinational corporations, have imposed as the way to maximize their profits in their notion of the one global economy. It's very short-sighted even for them. Because at a certain point, if no one is making enough to buy things, they destroy their own demand. It's very short-term thinking. We can stop this for its serious damage to us and our futures by, number one, exposing this major TPP, really corporate power tool attack. It's a corporate power tool for what it is, by going to tradewatch.org, getting the information, connecting to the videos, passing it around, putting it on your Facebook. This has been done successfully. Let me give you just one example. The Prime Minister of Japan wanted to join the TPP. The public there, despite being blocked, all coverage in the mainstream media, has made such a national storm, firestorm of controversy, that in fact the Prime Minister has not been able to drag them into this mess. In New Zealand, front page stories every week about the threats to their environment, to their democracy. So here in the U.S., where unfortunately our government is the leading pusher of the most extreme parts of this proposal, we need to do our job to get the word out, number one, to our friends, our colleagues, but number two, to our members of Congress, who ultimately decide what our trade policy is. Right now we have runaway trade negotiators, and we do have President Obama, who for all of his slipperiness on NAFTA, did make very detailed commitments when he was a candidate not to have these foreign tribunals. This was the part of him that's the law professor that understood this problem, that agreed that there would not be any products coming into this country that didn't meet our standards, who promoted and to this day is on the road campaigning, promoting Buy America and expanding American manufacturing. By making this an issue that politicians who want our votes have to deal with, to be against the TPP, the NAFTA on steroids for the whole world, and to start turning around these old blood-sucking agreements, this is something we can do. This has been successful in the past. We have this power.
Only,
we have to use it.
Lori, only if the Democrats and those progressives who still trust in Obama, only if they hold him accountable in a moment, but in our next segment, I'm going to go over all of Obama's campaign statements on trade and globalization and show you that he's betrayed every single one. And now we have to hold him accountable. And also, I'm holding accountable non-commercial radio. I'm holding accountable MSNBC and National Public Radio and PBS that are supposed to have forums for more enlightened discussion that have not taken this on as they should have and looked at this as a consequence. Then I have to look at who are the people but global Democrats frequently, or Clinton Democrats, or corporate Democrats, whatever you want to call them. But it still comes down to the idea that these are not people willing to get in there and just show the truth on what this is. Instead, they're looking at their paychecks, they're looking at what they're told, self-censorship, or inclined not to discuss something that's just too controversial. And as you said, if the public gets light on this, I believe that they will be outraged. Well, we're going to do what we can, Lori. I thank you very much for not only this, but your understanding of the World Trade Organization on another program. I will invite you back just to take that bemoaneth on and show how there's no transparency. In fact, I'll bet if you stood outside Washington, D.C., and wherever you're at right now, and you ask 100 academics or people walking down the street, who runs the World Trade Organization? Do you know his name, his background? Do you know any of their board? Do you know any of the people? What do you want to bet that you couldn't find 1 in 100 that could give you an honest, detailed answer?
Yet that institution has so much power over our lives. I would love to come back and talk about that. The WTO is in effect. We can turn that around. Right now, we absolutely have the ability to make sure we don't have the TPP imposed on us. And as sort of the evidence of that, citizens bringing word of mouth exposure to this Free Trade Area of the Americas, the last attempt to have this sneaky, stealthy corporate power tool sort of coup d'etat via trade agreement, was derailed by word of mouth campaigning and people becoming outraged. That is our clue. We can do it again. Tradewatch.org gives you all the tools.
Well, we hope to do that. We've had two of our programs go viral in the last 10 days. And one on WikiLeaks, which went viral when I had the person from Norway's parliamentarian group on, and that went viral. And then another one went viral with almost 6 million views of a major new documentary on the war on health, the tyranny of the FDA. So hopefully your discussion, our following Arthur's discussion, and the information will be enough to get them, A, to go to citizenstrade.org to get educated and see what we're doing, your website, and all the other websites, so that we can get people on board. So thank you very much. Once again, give your website one last time.
It's tradewatch.org, and there are great funny videos. We have no copyright issues. Take our videos, spread them around. You can learn about TPP to music, TPP through a Yes Men stunt. Plus, there is every kind of fact sheet you can imagine, from the very short to the very long, on every one of these issues. Imported food safety, the environment, corporate power, access to affordable medicines, financial deregulation, how the TPP affects them all, and what you can do to put some sunshine on it.
We look forward to our next discussion, Lori.
Thank you very much.
Lori Wallach, a director of Public Citizens Global Trade Watch Division, talking about one of the most nefarious rules that could ever occur, the trade agreement, the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement. Back in a moment with more on this. Please stay with us. I'd like to welcome all of you. I'm Gary Nall. You're listening to the Progressive Commentary Hour. My guest, who I introduced at the top of the show, Arthur Stamoulis, is with us now, and he is the director for the Citizens Trade Campaign, a national coalition of environmental, labor, consumer, family, farm, religious, and civil society groups, and they're dedicated to economic justice and human rights and advancing them. His group is citizenstrade.org. That's their website. Once again, Arthur, nice to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
You had an opportunity to listen to our previous guest, Lori Wallach. Let us take a moment, and someone who could not be here, but I want to read the Trans-Pacific Partnership and a Global Attack on the 1% by Mark Vorfau, and then have you take it from there, all right?
Okay.
Okay, this is what he has to say. During this past week, an international cabal of corporate lobbyists met behind closed doors in San Diego, their aim to move the Trans-Pacific Partnership towards completion. For over 2 years, TPP negotiations have been in progress, yet the proposals and agreements made so far have been carefully kept from public view until recently. A leaked TPP document published by Public Citizen has revealed that 600 corporate advisors involved in the negotiations, including representatives of Verizon, FedEx, and Walmart, have been up to different things. Considering the contents of this document, it is no wonder why the public and even elected representatives have been kept in the dark. Publicity about the TPP is being described as Free Trade Act. This understates its scope. While the FTAs already in existence have raked in giant profits for the corporate elite, for workers internationally, they have resulted in layoffs and a race to the bottom in terms of living conditions and rights. The big business tops have been working hard to enhance the power of their money-making weapons of mass destruction. If NAFTA was a hand grenade, then the Trans-Pacific Partnership is a bunker buster. What is perhaps most astonishing about TPP is its architects' disregard for the consequences of its destructive potential. Their greed has blinded them to the political instability and popular revolt the consequences of TTP will create. The corporate elite imagines their rule to be absolute and eternal. Sheltered by these illusions and goaded on by the need to increase their riches regardless of social cost, they are creating a bomb that could be blown up in their face. Currently, the countries in on the TPP are the United States, Australia, Chile, Malaysia, New Zealand, Peru, Singapore, and Vietnam. These countries alone are a combined market of 658 million people worth $20 trillion annually. Canada, Japan, and Mexico are also expected to get on board. The TPP also has built-in mechanisms to allow their nations to join after its ratification. While China could theoretically become a member, there can be little doubt that part of the intention of this pact is for the United States to build a coalition in which its big business interests dominate to compete against China's economic might. This ratcheting up of competition would result in greater political animosity. In turn, these consequences will contribute to a course towards greater conflict, including the possibility of war. This is because international capitalist competition is not determined by gentlemanly agreements, but by the law of the jungle and frequently brute force. While it may be a relatively simple matter for the United States to bully its economically weaker TPP partners into line, China is not so easily dominated. Other more crude and costly measures in diplomacy will be required to get the competitive upper hand, and the TPP is laying the foundation for this possibility. What all FTAs share in common, including TPP, is how they open up doors for multinational corporations to transfer operations to other nations where labor is cheaper and the profit rate is greater. In the first 10 years of NAFTA, this outsourcing resulted in the net loss of 879,280 U.S. jobs. Considering the greater number of countries involved in TPP, this number of lost jobs will be all the greater. In addition, for the nations these jobs are outsourced to, the results are even more devastating. The dislocation of local economies by the larger scale corporations moving in also results in greater unemployment. For instance, NAFTA resulted in the loss of 1.3 million Mexican farm jobs as U.S. agribusiness moved in, leaving the farmers to toil for a living in the brutal areas and with nothing given, and then turning around and prosecuting the illegal immigrants who could no longer farm for themselves, take care of themselves, and came over to America. Even more damaging was how NAFTA accelerated the privatization of Mexico's once strong public sector, resulting in huge layoffs, wage cuts, and a dramatic drop in the country's unionization rate. Other than for a well-connected few within the developing nations, signing on to TPP, there is nothing to gain and much to lose for these country's citizens if this agreement is enacted. When the TPP departs from past FTAs, it is the range of issues it covers and the degree it flagrantly defies national sovereignty in favor of more multinational corporate interest. Only two of TPP's 26 chapters have to do with trade. The rest are focused on new corporate rights and privileges and tools to override all local or national governing interest. Perhaps the most controversial of these tools would be the setting up of a three-attorney tribunal with no checks on conflicts of interest to judge foreign corporation complaints regarding government regulations in the countries they are setting up operations in. If, for instance, a foreign-owned corporation argues it is losing profits because of its host nation's overtime laws, this tribunal could rule that the country's taxpayers owe that corporation compensation for this loss. Such costly judgments could result from any regulations, including labor law, local environmental standards, financial rules, etc. In short, the TPP's tribunal would act as the hammer of multinational corporate interest above the power of the state's governments they do business with. While, because of their size, U.S.-based corporations have the most to gain from this arrangement, it will result in not only a greater deterioration of the living standards of those working in the United States, but also any semblance of democracy as well. As negotiated under the Obama administration by U.S. Trade Representatives Ron Kirkland, the TPP is extreme, very extreme. Public interest and national sovereignty are sacrificed on the altar of a corporate agenda to a degree that is doubtful a Republican president could get away with. Should it be passed into law, revolts against it are likely. This will set into motion events that will not go as planned by the 1% behind the measure. The time is now to start trying to defeat TPP. Now, that's what he is saying. That is from Mark Vorpal, who is a union steward, a social justice activist, and a writer for Workers' Action. Now let us take it over to you, and remaining time, I want you to lay out what you believe we have not learned up to this point, why we have been sold out, who has sold us out, and why this president has been able to get a clean pass from the media, both the left and the right, as if this was not one of the worst pieces of legislation in American history. The forum is yours, Arthur.
So clearly, the TPP is a major corporate power grab. This is the largest free trade agreement ever proposed, as has been said before. It not only includes the countries that are currently at the negotiating table, but it's a docking agreement, meaning that other countries can dock on or join over time. The U.S. Trade Representative Ron Kirk has already said he envisions it eventually covering half of the countries of the world. So the sky is really the limit. And what corporations are pushing for with this are two things. Number one, to continue making it easier for them to ship jobs around the world to wherever labor is the most exploited, environmental regulations are the weakest. The brands, the retailers, the Walmarts of the world see the TPP as a way to find a lower cost supply chain alternatives to China. They view workers there as being overpaid, believe it or not. And so they're pressing to open up new supply chains in countries like Vietnam, where sweatshop workers earn only a third to a half of what Chinese sweatshop workers make. And as Lori, you know, detailed at length, is how the TPP would serve to handcuff government's abilities to regulate in the public interest. Environmental regulations, food safety regulations, banking regulations, public procurement rules, all would come under attack under this. Right now, there are 600 corporations that have been granted access to the negotiating text, so they're allowed to review and propose changes to the text. Meanwhile, our trade negotiators have refused to tell us what they're proposing in our names. There are, again, 26 chapters to this agreement. About four of them have been leaked on our website, citizenstrade.org. And what they show is, number one, you know, the U.S. pushing a radical big pharma agenda to extend the length of drug patents, which would jack up prices for medicine here in the United States and reduce access to affordable generic medications for people in developing countries, often living on less than $2 a day for things like tuberculosis, AIDS medications. That's a literal death sentence for many, many people around the world. Brand name HIV medications can cost well over $10,000 per patient per year. Once they become generics, the price can go down to under $100 per patient per year. Still a lot of money, but in the realm of the possible in terms of treating sick people throughout the world. This would extend drug patents beyond the 20 years that corporations already get, almost indefinitely. The cap is not placed on it. There are all sorts of procedural ways where corporations could extend their patents a year here, a year there, 5 years here, 5 years there. And as was said last month, the investment chapter of this agreement leaked. That shows the United States pushing to allow transnational corporations to challenge virtually any law, regulation, or even court decision that negatively affects their expectation of profits. And again, these challenges aren't heard in domestic courts. They're heard in international tribunals that circumvent our domestic judicial systems. So this is a corporate power grab. It's about giving access to cheaper labor for big corporations, which is going to, you know, cost more job loss here in the United States, drive down the wages and benefits for the jobs we have left, reduce the tax base available for our schools, our infrastructure, our critical public services. It's about extending drug patents for big pharma. It's about giving big oil new tools for attacking environmental rules. It's about giving the so-called life sciences corporations new tools for attacking the precautionary principle and consumer right to know laws. It's about giving Wall Street new tools for attacking financial regulations. So this is a big, big deal, and we need to be working on it. And as has been said, you know, the corporate media isn't covering it. It's up to us to get the word out grassroots style and through our independent media to drag this out into the light, because if it continues behind closed doors as it has been for the past couple of years now, we know we're going to get stuck with a trade agreement for, by, and of the 1%, and it's going to have detrimental, hugely detrimental impacts for working people, for consumer safety, for the environment and democracy itself here and around the world.
I appreciate those statements, Arthur. Let us now go into some of the specifics. President Obama, for 12 years, was a constitutional professor, mainly at the University of Chicago. He also had a lot of clients in private practice and represented the coal industry, and they came up with the idea of clean coal. That's an oxymoron. And he, as a constitutional professor, knows that this law, that this treaty and its governing principles would exceed the power of our Constitution, our Bill of Rights, and our Supreme Court, and any judicial body in the United States. How in the world is this not a coup d'etat? Explain that to me.
It certainly is. It's a corporate coup d'etat, a corporate power grab. You know, then Senator Barack Obama specifically campaigned against what's called investor-state dispute resolution under these types of trade agreements. Just to explain the difference between the World Trade Organization's dispute resolution and what's proposed in the TPP, under the World Trade Organization, individual governments can challenge each other's laws as so-called barriers to trade. So just a week ago Friday, the United States lost an appeal on country of origin labels for meat products. The WTO ruled that Americans don't have the right to know what countries their meat is coming from. We've seen our tobacco controls challenged. We've seen internet gambling laws challenged. We've seen parts of the Clean Air Act, the Endangered Species Act, the Marine Mammal Protection Act challenged under the WTO. The United States has lost over 90% of the 65-plus cases brought against us by other governments within the World Trade Organization. The Trans-Pacific Partnership, or TPP, goes even further than that by allowing individual corporations to issue challenges. Governments always have, you know, diplomatic concerns. You know, they're only going to bring the cases that they feel are the most important to their economy. This would grant individual corporations the right to access these tribunals and challenge, again, any law, any regulation, any new court decision that cuts into their expectations of profits as a so-called indirect expropriation. These are regulatory takings cases that would be laughed out of American courts, but these tribunals in the past have taken very, very seriously, and it's a big deal. In the past, generally, U.S. corporations have used these powers to attack the laws of developing countries, and that would certainly expand under the TPP. But by expanding this throughout the Pacific Rim to countries like Japan that have large investments in the United States and have very powerful transnational corporations in their own right, our own laws, our own regulations, our own court decisions are put at much greater jeopardy than we've seen in the past. So this, you know, it absolutely is a corporate coup d'etat. Members of Congress who actually take the time to look at it, to consider it, are appalled, but unfortunately most of them don't. Most of them, you know, are just listening to corporate lobbyists. They're not paying attention. The media is not holding them accountable. And as a result, you know, the corporations get their way, and we need to stop that.
There's also the irony that those individuals in the media on the right, Rush Limbaugh and Sean Hannity and Glenn Beck, who talk about the Constitution a great deal and the Bill of Rights and Made in USA and proud of the USA, very nationalistic fervor, they are completely on the side of allowing this to happen. And they're utter hypocrites. In every sense, they're hypocrites. On the left, the people that you would think would come out, the darlings of MSNBC, they're not coming out against this. On non-commercial radio, and I won't mention names, but I'm appalled at how they'll take on something dealing with Syria or Libya and show some problems around the world, but they won't take this on because you're taking on the people that fund the foundations. Gee whiz, I wonder what the audience would think if they knew how much money some of the people on the left make in their foundations each year. So they stay away from certain landmines that if you touch that, you're not going to get any more funding. And the think tanks and the guests on some of these programs that you see, and especially on NPR. I mean, NPR, it's one thing to be Wonder Bread for the brain, something else to just remove the head and below the waist and say this represents an insight. It doesn't. I don't see these people being taken on. I don't see Obama being challenged. I don't see the New York Times taking them on. I see the only people willing to take this issue to the public attention are independent, progressive-minded people who are not a part of the corporate agenda. Your thoughts?
Well, certainly we've seen the corporate media and, frankly, much of public media reduced to, I think it was David Barsamian who said, the role of stenographers to power. They report on, you know, they write down what powerful people have said, and that's what passes for reporting all too often in this country. You know, there are very, very powerful interests behind these trade agreements. They stand to make billions and billions of dollars.
Trillions collectively each year. Arthur, my last question for you, but I want to get this in because I promised that we would go over the 2008 campaign promises on trade and globalization, and has Obama honored him? Here are some. His vision of trade policies, quote, are not sustainable if they favor the few rather than the many. He stated, quote, deals must not come as a blank checks, and our support will only be, quote, coupled with an insistent call for reform. He promised to reform key global institutions, including World Trade Organization and G8, so they, quote, will be more reflective of 21st century realities. Quote, specifically stated, the World Trade Organization must improve transparency and accountability. Quote, promise that consumer products coming in from other countries must be truly safe. Quote, promise to enforce trade laws that safeguard workers and farmers, quote, from unfair trade practices, including currency manipulation, lax consumer standards, illegal subsidies, and violations of workers' rights and environmental standards. Quote, promise of enforcing international laws on environmental standards. Promise that no further bilateral agreements, quote, will stop the government from protecting the environment, food safety, or the health of its citizens. Give greater rights to foreign investors than to U.S. investors. Require that the privatization of our vital public services or prevent developing country governments from adopting humanitarian licensing policies to improve access to life-saving medications. Promise to amend NAFTA so that it works better for all three North American countries. Promise of a national infrastructure reinvestment bank to create nearly 2 million new jobs. Are you familiar that he has done any of that?
No,
he hasn't.
He's done a complete 180. He promised that one of his first acts as president would be to renegotiate NAFTA, and the TPP is a very perverse way of keeping that campaign pledge. It's expanding NAFTA both in its geographic scope, but also the scope of powers it gives to corporations. And, you know, President Obama, our members of Congress, our media, all need to be held accountable.
He also repeated calls that that we would not allow any other government or corporation to use trade as a tool to leverage human rights, democracy, economic growth, job creation, or poverty alleviation. He promised to address climate change, quote, with binding and enforceable commitments to reduce emissions, especially for those that pollute the most. He also promised that this would also be a leading agenda. Once again, when you look at the actual statements, when you look at what was a matter of platform and policy, and then you see that not one of these has been met, to the contrary, he has brought the Trojan horse to our society, and now out of it pops 700 individuals representing corporate interest in the form of a Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement. This is a coup d'etat of the corporate elite. And the American media has chosen to be obedient, and the corporate Democrats, we would expect them to be in alignment with Obama, and they are. And so it's up to my guest and other guests who you will hear and when we challenge this to inspire citizens. Arthur, your group is citizenstrade.org. That's your website. If people contact you, will you be able to give them some instruction how to go forward on this?
Absolutely. There's new legislation, there's new bills, there are demonstrations out of every one of these negotiating rounds, and we could use all the help we can get. It's the president is not going to do it for us. No elected official is going to do it on their own. It's up to us, your listeners, to really make sure that the TPP is derailed.
We will do all we can to help your efforts.
Thank you.
I'm Gary Nall. Thank you all for listening. This has been the Progressive Commentary Hour. My guest, Arthur Stemulis, citizenstrade.org. Please become aware, become involved, because our elected representatives and the media are not on our side on this one. Have a good day.